With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Tudor Chimney by A.N.L. Munby. I am an indefatigable note-taker. A lifetime of antiquarian studies has led to a most formidable accumulation of material. Shelves of notebooks, cupboards, and trunks of papers bear witness to my enthusiasms and, I like to think, to my industry. Nor can I bear to throw anything away. I have too much of the magpie in me for that. So far, I have successfully resisted the efforts of motherly women's friend to clear out all that rubbish and my commonplace books of what struck me as curious and interesting 30 years ago provide me with occasional reading matter of a particularly delightful nature. I have indeed one regret. When I was young and ambitious, I vowed that I would consciously index all of my entries, a resolution which I kept for nearly 3 months. The task now is too Herculean, even to bear thinking about. Luckily, I have a memory above the average, particularly for what the more practical of my friends rudely dismiss as scraps of useless knowledge, and one of these despised scraps once stood me in very good stead. When Simon Venn first told me of his project, I supported it enthusiastically. For he is a very rich man. To restore a derelict house to its former glory is no occupation for the possessor of a modest income. Though the initial purchase of such a property may be effected for the proverbial song, the illusion of a bargain is soon shattered by the long face of the inspecting architect and by still longer accounts from the local builder. But considerations of this nature weigh little with a man whose fortune is based upon the secure foundation of a century-old whiskey distillery. The finding, however, of a suitable house for renovation proved surprisingly difficult. He told me that he had explored perhaps a score of properties offered by optimistic agents. He had visited Tudor houses, not a brick of which could have been laid earlier than the 18th century, and a Georgian mansion which could hardly have been designed before the Great Exhibition. He had seen one or two perfect houses in settings hopelessly spoiled by modern developments, and not a few glorious sights with houses unworthy of him. In fact, Venn had begun to despair of ever being able to dissipate his surplus wealth in this delightful way, and in a fit of pique, removed himself to the south of France. It was in the following May, the year was 1924, that I next heard from him. He had returned to England, and had happened upon the ideal house for a scheme in Berkshire. The letter was written in an exultant tone that reflected the enthusiasm of the man. Nothing would suffice but that I came down at once to see it. The purchase had been completed and work was already beginning. He would make no attempt to describe the place. No words could do justice to its charms, and much more in the same strain. There followed minute instructions from the drive down. The letter was headed "The Old Hall, Didenham," a village which lay, according to my friend's information, in the downs between Wantage and Lambourne. Such an invitation was much to my liking. I consulted my engagement book, told several white lies over the telephone, and found myself possessed of 4 clear days. A telegram to Venn, some hasty packing, and my arrangements were complete. By noon, I was speeding along the Great West Road, pleasantly deserted on a fine mid-morning week. Lunch at Reading delayed me for 30 minutes, but by 2:30, I was on the last lap of my journey. Landbourne was behind me, and I climbed steadily up the second-class road onto the Downs. I've always loved these spacious chalk uplands, and Venn had chosen to settle in an area much favored by ancient man. The prehistory of the neighborhood was fairly well known to me. The White Horse, Uffington Castle, and Wayland Smithy had been visited and revisited, but I had never before approached this stretch of the Downs from the south side. Some way short of the summit, I turned up a side lane, breasted a ridge, and before me, I saw what I knew must be my destination. I stopped the car and gazed in appreciation at the scene before me. 300 yards away was the house, set in a reentrant of the hill and sheltered on 3 sides. I could not see the village itself, but the tower of a church just showed itself above some fine beeches to the right. From the eminence on which I had stopped, I looked down upon the old hall, a building whose mellow red brick glowed in the afternoon sun. I tried to guess its date and put it down as early 16th century, which I subsequently learned was an accurate estimate. It was built upon an H plan, and at each end was a great multiple chimney stack, displaying those spiral brick chimneys which were so dear to the heart of the Tudor builder. Round one of the stacks, scaffolding had been erected, from which I presumed that Venn had wasted no time in getting to work. What I could see of the grounds was frankly disappointing. To the front were a few acres of indifferent parkland, but behind the house, I could just perceive the angle of a high wall, which gave promise of a sheltered garden to the rear. The general effect of the whole was somewhat dilapidated, but by no means derelict. I restarted the car, and in a couple of minutes, I was receiving a smiling greeting from my host manservant, an old acquaintance of mine, and a great chatterbox. "Well, Dawson," I said, "how do you like your new home?" "Very nice, sir," he replied. "And by the time Mr. Benz finished with it, it should be a regular showpiece. But when he tells me what he's going to do, I sometimes doubt if he will ever finish it, in my lifetime, that is." "Oh, come," I said, "surely it's not as bad as all that." "Well, sir," he responded, "I shall be very surprised if we get the workmen out this side of Christmas. I can't understand what's come over the master. Take the dining room, for instance. It may be a bit on the small side, but it's cozy-like, intimate, if you know what I mean. Well, Mr. Venn is not only joining it up with a drawing room, but believe it or not, he's going to take the first floor out so that it goes right up to the roof. I've never heard of such a thing. Think of heating the place, sir," I said. He broke off suddenly as my friend appeared and became very busy picking up my bags. "I heard you, Dawson," said Venn, laughing, and added as the old man went off with my luggage. "Poor old Dawson, I'm afraid he doesn't appreciate the excitement of tracing out exactly where the Great Hall used to be. I'm delighted that you've come. I do hope that you won't be too uncomfortable. We're camping out in the West Wing during the alterations and having our meals in the library." He glanced at his watch. "We've got an hour before tea," he said. "Just nice time to give you a general view of the place. I'll show you the plans for restoration after dinner." It would be unreasonable to inflict upon the reader an account of my tour of the house, especially as it has little bearing upon the events to come. I will, however, admit that Venn's enthusiasm was amply justified. The latent possibilities of the place were enormous. I saw it all, from the little walled 16th century herb garden to the topmost attic, in which were visible the hammer beams that would become once more the roof of the hall when the intervening floors had been cleared away. In his bedroom, Venn showed me, with pride, part of the original hall screen incorporated in some later paneling. The house was bigger than I had realized. There must have been quite 14 bedrooms, and it was just on 4 o'clock by the time we reached the ground floor again. "There is just one more thing I'd like you to see before tea," said Venn, leading the way into a small room at the east end of the house. It seemed to be the room in which the workmen had made their headquarters, for it was full of buckets, ladders, and the usual paraphernalia. "What do you think of that?" said my host. "Isn't it extraordinary?" He was pointing to the fireplace, which appeared to be the oldest and was certainly the finest in the house. Above the great stone Tudor arch was a chimney piece of carved oak, richly decorated with mythological figures and heraldic devices. The extraordinary aspect of the splendid relic lay in it being bricked up. The whole of the fireplace had been walled across. "This room was one half of the small parlor of the Tudor house," said Van, "and I intend to join it up with the housekeeper's room next door and use it as my study. But can you conceive anyone bricking up this magnificent fireplace and substituting that?" With a wave of his hand, he indicated an indifferent cast iron stove on the other side of the room. "Thank heaven they didn't destroy it. One of my first jobs is to get it into use again." "That shouldn't take long," I said, "providing the chimney itself hasn't been tampered with." At this moment, a workman entered the room, and seeing Van there, he touched his cap respectfully. Van nodded and said, "How long would it take you to knock a few bricks out of this?" He tapped the walled-in area as he spoke. The workman cast a professional eye over it. "Well, sir," he said, "if it's only one brick thick, I should say about 20 minutes. Would you like me to have a go at it, sir?" "Just in the middle. I won't go near the stonework at the sides in case I damage it. That'll want handling careful." He seized the hammer and chisel, and as we went off, the little room resounded with a ring of steel upon mortar. We had nearly finished tea when the parlor maid brought a message that the man working on the chimney would like to have a word with Mr. Venn. He entered awkwardly, cap in hand, and said, "Beg pardon, sir. I didn't ought to trouble you, but I hope I haven't done wrong with that chimney. I've knocked a hole in them bricks, like what you said, but there isn't half a nasty smell coming out of it. I should say whoever bricked up that there fireplace got a reason for it, sir." "What sort of a smell?" I asked. "Well, sir," he said, "it's what you might call a bit hard to give a name to. It isn't drains, at least. I'd be very surprised if it was, but it's just nasty. It's as if something's burning what didn't ought to burn. Perhaps the gentleman wouldn't mind stepping along and trying it for yourselves." We rose and followed him back to the scene of his operations. As we filed into the room, the cause of his perturbation became apparent. There was a smell, not very strong, but nonetheless insistent, a kind of kitchen smell, but not the sort that any clean, well-ordered kitchen could produce, an infinitely stale reek of burnt fat and offal. The effect was, to say the least, disagreeable. Van flung the windows open, and some of the pungency was lost. "I think it's just stale air from the chimney," he said. "Just loosen some more bricks, and let's see if it's blocked higher up." It was the work of only a few minutes to enlarge the aperture to respectable size, and Van cautiously inserted his head and shoulders. "I can see the sky," he said, and his voice sounded muffled and thin, as though it were far away. "There's no other blockage," he went on. "I can't see anything that would cause a smell." He gave a sharp exclamation and withdrew his head sharply, not before a certain amount of dust had lodged in his hair. From the chimney came the rustle and thud of falling debris. "Damn those starlings," said Van ruefully, looking at his head in a wall mirror. "I thought I saw something moving up inside the flue. Quite a big bird by the look of it. More like a jackdaw than a starling, though I haven't seen one around the house. I expect there's a nest up there which wants clearing out." As he spoke, something else came fluttering down inside the flue and stuck on the jagged hole in the brickwork. I took the tongs from the stove and pulled it out, but it was only a small bundle of rags, filthy and charred, and with an exclamation of disgust, I dropped them back into the grate. I don't think much else happened that day, which is relevant to this narrative. After dinner, Van and I spent an interesting couple of hours in the library with his architect's plans, and there was much talk of buttery, solars, and minstrel galleries, which I will spare the reader. We went up to bed at about 11. At that foot of the stairs, Van said, "It's a funny thing, but I seem to have got that damn smell in my nostrils. Could swear I got a whiff of it then. I sniffed hard, but couldn't be certain. I'll just see if the door of the room is shut," he added. "Otherwise, the whole house will reek of it." He returned in a few seconds. "It was shut," he said. "I had a look inside, and oddly enough, I couldn't smell it at all in the room. Oh, well, the whole chimney can be cleaned out in a day or two." He wished me good night, and I retired to my room, where I slept excellently. I'm a reasonably early riser, and the following day dawned so bright that there was no inducement to linger in bed. I resolved to take a short walk before breakfast and was dressed by 8. It was thus that I inadvertently overheard a conversation at the foot of the stairs. I call it a conversation, though it was more in the nature of a monologue, delivered in somewhat petulant tones by the charwoman, a stout lady of about 50, who had been pointed out to me on the previous day. The workman with whom I was already acquainted formed a reluctant audience. "You men are all the same," the charwoman was saying. "Eat your heads off and expect everyone to run about clearing up after you. I'll be glad to see the last of you, that I will. Mind you, I'm a reasonable woman. But what I say is that there's necessary mess and there's unnecessary mess. I know you can't carry out alterations without breaking the place up. Though I can't be left like it is, I don't know. When it comes to strewing your nasty burnt rags up and down my nice clean passages, that's another thing altogether. And I won't have it. You've got a room, haven't you, to make your filthy messes in?" "Now look here, Mrs. Fisher," interposed the workman. "I tell you straight that them rags has nothing to do with me. There was a few old rags from the chimney, but they was left in the grate. Why should you think I want to go strewing them around the house? I got my work to do." "Well, you go and get on with it," the acid voice of Mrs. Fisher broke in. "And if I have any more trouble, I'll go straight to the master, and that goes for the whole lot of you. And if I seize the foreman, I'll give him a piece of my mind, but as much good as a sick headache it is." The workman made his escape, and I descended the stairs. The grieved charwoman was engaged in sweeping a small heap of charred rags into her dustpan, an action which was punctuated by much muttering. "Good morning," I said. "It's a lovely day." She agreed reluctantly, and I hastily passed by in case she should start airing her grievances afresh. I remember wondering idly how it was that the rags, apparently from the chimney, should have found their way into the passage, but the whole thing seemed too trivial to worry about. I took a brisk walk up onto the hillside and returned to breakfast half an hour later in high spirits. The day passed pleasantly enough. At about 10, my host architect arrived, and the three of us examined in greater detail what I had inspected cursorily on the previous day. I liked Henson, the architect, a youngish man and a wholehearted enthusiast for the scheme. Our pleasure was, however, slightly marred by one thing. In different parts of the house, we kept getting occasional whiffs of the smell from the unblocked chimney. One, two, or three occasions, the pungent, unmistakable reek came to my nostrils, then it was gone. Henson smelt it too and remarked on it, but all our efforts to pin it down to any particular place were unavailing. The chimney itself, which we examined, was quite free of it, and its source remained elusive. The flue upon inspection proved to be quite clear. There was no trace of birds or nest, another minor mystery. I don't want you to think that we took all this very seriously at the time, but I am writing in the knowledge of what was to come, and these apparent trivialities then take on a more somber aspect. It was on the following morning that we got our first inkling of more sinister matters. After breakfast, I took a turn upon the terrace, and then went to join Venn in the library, where it was his habit to read his morning mail. As I opened the library door, I noticed his old manservant Dawson was seated in a chair, in itself an unusual occurrence, and was engaged in earnest conversation with his master. I was about to retire again, but Venn called to me. "Come in," he said, "and listen to this. Dawson says he's seen a ghost." His tone was light, but his face, which he turned to me, was grave, and I could see that he was worried. I knew Venn was genuinely fond of the old man, and looked pale and shaken as he had sat hunched into one of the library armchairs. "Well, sir, that's how it is," said Dawson. "I couldn't stay another night in this house, not if you were to pay me £1,000,000. Not but what I shall be very sorry to leave you, sir, and after all these years, too, and I will say that I could never hope to have a better master, but I'm not as young as I used to be, and another turn like the one I got last night would just about finish me. I didn't sleep a wink, sir, and I don't think I ever should under this roof. All night long, I could see that figure standing there at the foot of the stairs, looking at me. It fair gives me the creeps to talk about it now," Venn interposed. "What we'd better do is this, Dawson. You are going to take your holiday anyway in a month's time. Were you going to stay with your married sister at Hans Danton again?" Dawson nodded. "Well," my friend continued, "let's send her a prepaid wire and see if she can have you now. There's no hurry about your coming back. You can take an extra month if you like. And by the time we shall have got this place a bit more shipshape, I expect the upheaval of the moves upset you. But I'm certainly not going to accept your notice straight away. See how you feel in 6 weeks' time. What do you say about that? With apparent reluctance, Dawson allowed himself to be persuaded into accepting these arrangements. The wire was sent. A favorable reply was received, and by midday, Dawson and his luggage had left for the station. Before he went, the old man drew me on one side. "Look after Mr. Benz, sir," he said. "You excuse the liberty. I wouldn't like anything to happen to him. And believe me, sir, there's something downright evil loose in this house." He shook his head sadly, climbed into the car, and was borne away. At lunch, I asked Van what exactly it was that Dawson had seen. "That's just the stupid part about it," he answered. "He either couldn't or wouldn't give a coherent account of it. All he did was to keep repeating some nonsense about a figure standing and looking at him. He was so upset that I didn't like to press him for any further details. The only thing he did say at all definite was that the appearance was accompanied by a fearful smell, which is, of course, suggestive. Beginning to think that perhaps I was a bit hasty in having that chimney unblocked. A good mind to have it boarded up again for the time being." "Let it wait for another day," I said. "We may see something for ourselves. If you break up the hole again, you'll never really have any peace of mind here. We've got to try to find out more about it. A ghost isn't the sort of thing one can shut away and keep out of one's mind." There, the matter was left, and by unspoken mutual consent, we made no further reference to it during the day. It is with extreme reluctance that I come to the next part of my narrative. I'm aware that I cut no very heroic figure in it, though I hope I am old enough not to worry about that. But I do not even now like to remind myself of the horror and panic that seized me. There are certain human passions that strip from a man the veneer of civilized culture which normally encases him, that turn him into something primitive and elemental. I felt myself spiritually naked when face to face with the apparition that confronted me that night. But I am anticipating. Ven and I spent the evening together in the library. He had some letters to write, and I was quite content to smoke and examine his books. At about 10:30 he rose from his bureau and proposed going to bed. I said that I would read for a little longer, but I hoped that he wouldn't wait up for me. He looked a little dubious at this, but I assured him that I was quite happy to sit up alone. This was not mere bravado. I felt it unlikely at the time that I should actually see anything. Indeed, I became quite absorbed in my book after my friend had left me. I was sitting not far from the door, and the room was lit by a single reading lamp. I was smoking my pipe, and after about 20 minutes, I found it necessary to refill it. It was then that I first realized that the smell, which I was coming to know so well, was pervading the room. At the first whiff of that sickening reek, I sat quite still and listened, but I could hear nothing. Nonetheless, the atmosphere of the room had changed in some infinitely subtle way. The gloom outside the range of the single light seemed to have become more intense and to have assumed an oppressive, malignant quality. The mild May evening seemed to have grown colder, for I was conscious of shivering. As I sat there holding my breath, I was aware that I was not alone in the room. Something else was present, immediately behind me. How I detected this, I do not know, but I was nonetheless certain of it. With an effort of will, I slowly turned my head, for I was intensely curious. I wish to God now that I had not given way to my curiosity, for what I saw still haunts me. Just on the outer edge of the lamplight, a figure was standing, and I hope I never see anything again so monstrous and so repellent. It was a man, but had the aspect of no living man. Its form was covered with the charred remnants of clothing. The bare legs were horribly thin. There were nothing but burnt skin and blackened bone, but it was the head that made my very blood run cold. It was hairless and scorched. The face was nothing more than a featureless, seared, leathery mask. It was the face of a man long dead. But the eyes were alive. They glowed behind the mask with a baleful infernal light that radiated malevolence. In far less time than it takes to write these words, I was on the far side of the door and fumbling with the key. The lock was stiff from long disuse, and I found it would not turn. As I struggled with it, something gripped the handle on the far side and pulled. Sick with panic, I tugged with one hand, and with the other I wrestled with the lock. With a sudden jerk, the key turned, and I was standing sweating and panting in the dark passage. On the panels of the door, I could hear something scraping and scratching. I ran as fast as my legs would carry me up to Ven's room. He was in bed but jumped up when he saw me. "Good heavens, man," he said. "What's the matter with you? Sit down." I looked at myself in the mirror and realized the cause of his consternation. I was white and breathless. My face was moist with beads of sweat. He poured me out a glass of brandy from his medicine chest, and as I gulped it down, I told him what I had seen. His first reaction was to go to the door and lock it. Then he seated himself on the bed again. "You'd better sleep in my room," he said. "There's a spare bed in my dressing room that we can bring in here. I can find you some pajamas. I don't suppose you want to pass the night alone, and I certainly don't." Far into the night, we discussed the matter. Ven decided that as the following day was a Sunday, and the workmen would not be coming, he would move his belongings to the inn at Lambourne and stay there for a while. The two servants could easily be given a holiday. The work of restoration could continue by daylight for the time being, but no one would sleep in the house. I questioned him closely on what he knew of the history of the place, but he had little to tell me. He had purchased it in a great hurry, and it had been empty for some years previously. He believed that it had changed hands several times in the last 50 years. "I do remember one thing," the agent told me, he said. "It hasn't always been called the Old Hall. Originally, it had another name." He told me what it was, but I'm damned if I can remember it now. He thought for a few moments. "No," he continued, "it's no good. I've forgotten. I'd know it if I heard it, though." We agreed to follow up this line on the next day and to inquire after any local traditions concerning the house. It was sometime later that I had an inspiration. "What about the heraldry on the chimney piece?" I asked. "That ought to tell us who one of the early owners was. As far as I recollect, there was a coat of 3 birds' heads, ravens, I think. It may well have been a canting device. Does the name raven mean anything to you, or perhaps crow? Or some combination incorporating either of them? Crowby, Crowley?" "Crowsley," interjected Ven. "That was it. Crowsley Hall was the original name." I was silent for a long time. The name of Crowsley had stirred some vague chord in my mind, and I lay pondering where I had heard it before. At last, I thought I had it. It must have been nearly 20 years before when I examined and catalogued a vast mass of manuscript materials relating to the counties of Wiltshire and Berkshire in the genealogical and topographical collections of an early 19th-century antiquary, which were still in the possession of his descendants. I was almost certain that embedded somewhere in my voluminous notebooks I had some information relating to the name of Crowsley, and I decided that it was worth a visit to London in the morning to see if I could find it. I set off early, leaving Ven to arrange for the move to Lambourne, where I promised to join him in the evening. I spent the day delving among my accumulated papers and cursed myself, not for the first time, for my failure to compile an index. The afternoon was well advanced before I found that my memory had not played me false. I had made extensive notes upon the family of Crowsley, in particular upon that branch of the family to which Crowsley Hall had belonged. And certain passages which I had transcribed 20 years before seemed to have a considerable bearing upon our present troubles. I returned to Lambourne forthwith, and this is the gist of what I had to tell Ben after supper. The fortunes of the House of Crowsley were founded, like those of many more famous families, upon lands acquired at the dissolution of the monasteries. A certain Thomas Crowsley was in a peculiarly favorable position at this period, as he was steward to the great Benedictine Abbey of Abingdon, and was thus able to sell to himself several of the abbey's richest manors upon exceedingly advantageous terms. Among those he purchased, Didenham, with small manor house, which was largely rebuilt and named Crowsley Hall by its new occupant. Thus it was that almost overnight the steward of comparatively humble origin became a landowner. His elevation to the status of gentleman was not long delayed, as he received a grant of arms in 1547 and chose for his coat the punning device of the 3 birds' head. Party profess and sable 3 crows' head erased counterchanged. This was embodied in the great oak chimney piece, as we have seen. The majority of such parvenu families quickly adapted themselves to their new positions, and in a generation were indistinguishable from the long-established gentry. But this was not the case with the Crowsleys. In modern parlance, they did not fit in. They lived in constant friction with their neighbors, with whom they indulged in an orgy of bitter litigation. The Elizabethan records of the Court of Common Pleas leave no doubt upon this point. their impudent arrogance is attested by a contemporary letter in which the writer refers to the whole family as a saucy, overweening, contemptuous brood. Nor did the passing years seem to improve matters, for by the days of the early Stuarts, they had become the most universally detested family in the county. I have tried to sketch the background of intense local unpopularity because it had direct bearing upon the sequel. In 1640, the head of the family was a certain Julius Crowsley, a bachelor who lived alone at the Hall. He possessed all the unpleasant characteristics of his immediate forebears, and his arrogance and insolence were byword. He was, moreover, unfortunate enough to deliver himself into the hands of his enemies. One day he was out riding beyond the bounds of his estate. A closed gate barred his path, and he shouted to a boy standing nearby to open it for him. Whether the boy made some impertinent reply or was merely slow in complying, history does not relate. But the horseman lost his temper. He felled the child with the butt end of his whip and passed on. The boy, who was the son of a much respected yeoman farmer, sickened and died. The smoldering resentment of the countryside broke into flame, and Julius Crowsley was apprehended by the sheriff's men and brought to trial. In view of the high feeling that his action had roused, the prisoner exercised his option to be tried, not at the Reading Assize, but by his country, but in London. Here he managed to produce medical evidence that the boy was already ailing, and in view of the conflicting testimony of the doctors, he escaped with a fine. On May 1, 1640, he returned to his manor in triumph. The county was in an uproar. Two nights later, a party of friends of the bereaved family broke into the house intent on vengeance. What occurred is not recorded. Julius Crowsley disappeared, and his body was never found, nor were his assailants ever arrested. A conspiracy of sullen silence hung over the area, and the missing man's servants appeared to have been terrorized into holding their tongues. It is more than likely that the sheriff was half-hearted in his attempt to find the culprits, particularly as it was not certain whether the man was dead or had merely taken flight. The sheriff, too, would probably have shared the general approval which greeted Crowsley's disappearance, and in any case, the Civil War would have turned men's thoughts into other channels. These were the facts I had gleaned from my notes. It needed little imagination to supply the end of the story. I could picture Julius Crowsley in his house that evening, startled by the sudden arrival of armed men, his surprise turning to panic as he realized their mission. He would have sought about for some hiding place, and some unlucky chance must have led him to climb up into the chimney of the small parlor. Perhaps his presence there was detected or revealed by some treacherous servant, and his merciless pursuers kindled a fire in the hearth. I could picture the man's feelings as the first spirals of smoke eddied round him, and the tongues of flame began to lick around his feet. He would blindly have climbed higher, desperately clawing at the sooty brickwork. The chimney was too narrow at the top to allow the passage of a man's body, but one hopes that he was suffocated by the smoke into merciful unconsciousness before the flames had done their work. So much one could guess. Yet why was the spirit of the tortured man not at rest? Venn was deeply interested in my narrative. The rest of the story can be told in a few words. How we summon Henson, the architect, upon the following day. A close examination of the chimney revealed a disused side flue, which, with some difficulty, we uncovered behind the wainscoting in the room immediately above. The pitiful remains which we unearthed there were given a decent burial in the little churchyard of Didenham. The somber shadow of mystery and horror were thus dispelled, and the old house was at peace once more. The work of restoration is now complete, and I'm a frequent visitor. Dawson is in residence again and is as talkative as ever, except upon one particular subject.